Welcome, everybody. It is so exciting to have this episode running live on Instagram today, and I'm super thrilled for those that are tuning in live that we are not only going to be talking about Jordan Wong's music journey, but this interview is going to be a deep dive on the life of Jordan Wong. So for those that are listening, welcome. Welcome to the Inspire to Thrive podcast. I'm your host, Phoebe Lay, and I'm super excited to kick off the show. Jordy, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you here today.
Thanks, Phoebe. It's good to be here.
Jordy, for those that don't know you, you are a very talented musician and artist, and you also have a very interesting backstory, which we're going to dive into. But before we begin, I'd firstly like to know, can you tell us a little bit about your background in music and tell us how you got into music and what was your upbringing like?
The story of how I got into music is I was basically born into it, I think. One of my earliest memories and one thing my parents always tell me about is being in a cafe in Sydney when I was about maybe a year old and screaming my lungs out because my parents were leaving the cafe, but Eric Clapton was on the screen and I just would not let them leave. So we ended up staying there for a couple extra hours, just sitting there so I could listen to the music on the TV. And it was kind of like that ever from the point I was born, but ever since that point. I mean, when I was 2 years old, I still remember listening to and watching a live concert called Absolutely Live, a George Benson concert that my dad had bought of him playing in Ireland back when he was a bit younger than he is now, dancing in my lounge room, often with no clothes on, to Earth, Wind & Fire, Stevie Wonder and all of the greats, jumping on my bed in my house, listening to the vinyl player. Among other things, interestingly, despite all of my history with R&B, it was Come On Aussie, Come On that I'd like to put on the vinyl player and jump around like a madman. But my parents have been saturating me with quality music since I was born virtually, so I grew into it as naturally as breathing, really.
Wow, that's incredible. And how do you think that shaped you as an artist today?
Well, I think certainly just the fact that I was around all of this unbelievable music from such a young age pushed me into it. I had a feel for it. I had a desire to, I suppose, carry out in my own way the fun and the emotion and the feeling that was communicated to me through that music. I think also the type of the music I was listening to, as I said, George Benson, Stevie Wonder, Earth, Wind & Fire, the Bee Gees, Michael Jackson. I mean, I grew up around a lot of Motown music as well. The influence and the journey was quite linear and quite clear because when I first started singing at about the age of 7 or 8, this is when I started getting formal lessons. The first songs that I was doing was all of the stuff that Michael Jackson did when he was a kid. I'll Be There, Never Can Say Goodbye. I've still got videos of me as a 9-year-old in a full gold outfit, all sparkly, up on stage performing. So I think I was naturally just in it from the beginning because of having been saturated by it, watching it as well. I think that an interesting thing was it wasn't just CD players around the house. It was lots of live footage that I was being played on the TV of all of this stuff. One interesting story that I like to tell people, which is completely accurate but quite strange, is that I didn't really encounter any modern music until I was about 10 or 11. And only through other people playing stuff like Black Eyed Peas at school, stuff that was on the radio. I didn't listen to the radio. I listened to 60s and 70s, maybe got into a bit of the 80s as well, but I was an old soul and I was brought up on that stuff. So when kids were like, oh, come on, man, the best stuff around is, you know, My Humps and stuff. I'm like, but man, what about Freddie Mercury? What about Michael Jackson? And they're like, who are these people? Not Michael Jackson. I mean, people knew him, but what are you talking about? That stuff's 30 years in the past. Well, not for me, it wasn't. That was my present as a kid. So how it impacted me and how it influenced me was just the fact that it was constant. I was really passionate about it. My parents were really passionate about it, and that passion carried through to me. So I think that that's where the influence came from, and the type of music I was listening to clearly drove me into that R&B soul setting.
I believe your father and his record collection also had an influence on your music career. And
That's exactly what I've been talking about. It's his record collection that all of that music is contained in. So he was the one who was constantly playing it all the time. We had a CD player, an old Bang & Olufsen CD player that had 6 CD slots in it. And I would just constantly go from one to the next virtually every day. And sometimes he would throw new ones in there off out of his CDs, and I'd continue to be exposed to just all of this incredibly high quality music. And I think the only thing that deviated from R&B was Carlos Santana. I listened to him and he became probably my biggest guitar hero alongside Benson for a long time, but his record collection was extensive, but his taste in music was exceptional. And I think that played a huge role in me, first of all, wanting to do that sort of music, and second of all, aspiring to that level of quality when I wanted to do it. Even when I was a kid, I had an obsession with practicing and making sure that I imitated kid Michael Jackson to the exact tone. If my pitch was off as a kid, I was distraught. I think that's always been the way I've done it. And I think part of that is my personality, obviously, but part of it is that the quality of what I was listening to and the quality of those eras is still something I think from a raw music perspective, I don't think you get a better sense of quality than in the 60s and 70s where you couldn't use auto-tune, you couldn't use any electronic tricks to help you. You had to be perfect first take. And so I've adopted that philosophy in the way that I try and approach my music as well.
Geordie, your perfectionism and your diligence are well-known traits of yours for those that know you. How do you think that influences your creative process? And is that something that ever hinders the process, or would you say that it's actually an aid?
I'd say it both significantly hinders and significantly aids. It aids in the sense that I'm always striving for perfection. I'm always striving for the absolute best that anything can possibly be. Again, because I listen to the way that these artists sounded, the way that their tracks sounded, if I sing and I'm not sounding, in my opinion, that good, which I never feel I do, I'm always feeling like I'm short of the mark. And to me, that creates a couple of good things in that it makes me obsessively practice even more and strive to get even closer to that mark. It hinders it in the sense that I get very critical of myself to a ridiculous extent. I know everybody's a bit self-critical, but you know, I miss one note in a song during a live performance and I'll be brooding over it for the next day and a half probably. I mean, that might be short for me. It's the same when I'm songwriting. If I hear an idea that I'm playing and I'm not happy with it, I'll instantly toss it, which again leads to me producing some stuff that I'm happy with in terms of the quality. But often I get writer's block very badly because I'm so obsessed with finding a perfect line or something like that. And for that reason, I've struggled to songwrite by myself. I've struggled to create by myself sometimes. And it's really good to have other people. It's been really good to collaborate with other people in recent months in order to produce songs, because I've got this aspect where I want to be quite technical. I want to produce things that sound like the music that I grew up with as a kid. But then again, other people have completely creative ideas. And as consummate professionals, I'm able to accept and bring that into the fold. We feed each off each other really well, but it definitely hinders my process sometimes. If I have a bad recording session, if I have a bad practice session, because I listen to myself and I record myself every time I sing. If I have a bad session, the voice is not feeling good, I feel like I can't hold pitch properly, I'll go to bed pretty annoyed. I'll be thinking about it the next day and thinking, well, I need to redeem myself tonight, even just to myself. And obviously that's compounded if I have a bad performance, in my view. I'll be thinking about that for a while. And again, it's a double-edged sword. I'll get very down on myself, but at the same time, that'll inspire me to practice harder, work better, and do a better performance next time. So both extremes, I would say.
Geordie, you're not only just a typical, well, you are absolutely, definitely not a typical R&B artist. I mean, your heritage, which we're going to talk about in a moment, but your heritage makes you very unique. Your afro makes you very, very different and stand out. And you're also now in the middle of producing an album that is Mandopop. Tell me about that. Like, was that a shift? And Were you comfortable with that shift when you moved into Mandopop, or was that very seamless and it just flowed?
It was pretty seamless, actually. I think that both my Chinese heritage and my R&B have been with me since I'm young, so for me it wasn't strange. It seems strange perhaps from the outside. It's not like I ever woke up one day and said, why do I have an afro? I just had one. It is definitely strange that somehow this got past the Chinese dominant genes.
Yeah.
I suppose that's a sign, isn't it? As far as my R&B is concerned. The first time I really experienced Mandopop was when I was in Hong Kong with my dad in a record store course when I was 10. We heard this Mandopop track coming over the speakers in the store. We found out later it was a song called Cappuccino. It's a pretty cute little song. Actually, it had a Western rapper on it. And this was back in the early 2000s. So I think quite revolutionary at that stage for any sort of Mandopop to have that kind of influence on it. And my dad, up to a native Hong Kongian, I'm not sure exactly what the term is. And
honky.
A honky. All right, fair enough. And he said, what's this? What's this? And the guy goes, oh, this is Elva. And so we discovered Elva Hsiao, who is a Taiwanese singer, very, very famous. And from that point on, we started purchasing Chinese music. We started listening to Mandopop a bit more. But Mandopop, as you probably know, is very different to Western pop. They didn't open up in China until the 80s. So socially and in terms and developmentally in terms of their music industry, they were still very classic in terms of their style. What we think of in the 60s, for instance, what we call the doo-wop era in R&B, that sort of music was still hanging around in the early 2000s in China with very simple chord progressions, heavy focus on melody and somewhat cheesy lyrics. We were thinking, well, wouldn't it be interesting to hear somebody do R&B in Mandarin? And even now, it's still not really a thing. There are some import artists, some American artists, for example, Khalil Fong, who I am a great admirer of, who revolutionized the scene. David Tao is a very famous R&B singer in China who revolutionized R&B there as well. But it's still not really overly well understood because in China they're not growing up listening to Michael Jackson and Stevie Wonder and Earth, Wind & Fire and these sorts of people. They're not, you know, their lives are not surrounded by Justin Timberlake or Bruno Mars. It's started to flow in a little bit. There's more creativity there now than there's ever been before. There really hasn't been sort of a major, I would say, authentic R&B artist go in there and change the scene. That's why I found things to be quite seamless because, you know, being Chinese but also being an R&B artist, for me, moving into that space just made sense. Made sense from a business perspective. It made sense from a cultural perspective. I hadn't probably engaged in much intense Chinese culture. You know, it was not fringe. I was definitely in it, always having our little Chinese events with my family all the time. But for me, that was normal. That was natural. R&B is very separate from China by its nature. So it wasn't something I'd considered. But as soon as I did, it was something that I thought, this makes sense. This will work really well. You're probably familiar with this as well. Cantonese doesn't work very well with something like R&B, but Mandarin suits it perfectly.
I mean, Cantonese suits rap, but definitely when it comes to pop, I think Mandarin works. R&B, it's one of those things where it's interesting because your English music, that like the music that inspired you growing up, is old school soul. And when people think R&B, they do think the Bruno Mars and the Justin Timberlake.
Oh, look, R&B is the most ridiculously wide genre you can think of. Everything from, I mean, it's rhythm and blues. So everything from blues to funk to soul and gospel, it's all within the R&B diaspora. So yeah, sorry, I forgot what you were saying.
Well, I was going to say, so a lot of people would associate you and your look with the Justin Timberlake, Bruno Mars style. What would you say is more your style?
Oh, look, I absolutely love those artists as well. I wouldn't discount them. When I first discovered them, I had a great time listening to them and getting into them. So, you know, I wouldn't say that my influences are exclusively old school. Definitely my base and my foundation are. I like to incorporate modern elements, especially of production. Now that we do have the tools, why not use them? Mm. It's one of those things where we can absolutely admire what the people did in the past and say, that's incredible, but why limit ourselves when we've got the opportunity to do something additional in terms of the recording process, in terms of the production process? And we have to be, as artists, willing to adapt to current standards. You know, I can't really go out there singing 50s jump blues songs like Beans and Cornbread, which you're probably not familiar with, but you can probably tell from the sound of it, it probably wouldn't work in today's era. We can always appreciate that stuff, but we have to be willing to modernize and we have to be willing to change what we do. And so I absolutely love Justin Timberlake and Bruno Mars, what they're doing, not only musically, but stylistically in terms of their image, in terms of the way they present themselves, what they try to embody. And it's ironic we talk about Bruno Mars because a big thing that he's been doing over the last few years has been going back to a 60s, 70s sound. And I think that that's what I'd like to do, a modern version influenced by all of the old school stuff, because I feel like the lyrics in the old school stuff, the way that the music blends, the instrumentation, kind of chords and rhythms that they use, still haven't been replicated successfully today. And I think that a bit of modern, a bit of old school, a bit of Mandarin, a bit of English, I think that something like that works well.
Yeah, amazing. Geordie, you have a heritage of, you've got Australian, Hungarian, Chinese. Tell us about your heritage. Like, it seems like you're also quite a mix of different cultures. And would you say that the Chinese aspect of yourself was quite predominant, or would you say that, you know, it's something that you're just very passionate about? Because you would obviously need to be passionate to now be speaking Chinese so fluently and even singing in Chinese.
I think it's a couple of things. I think that my dad is Hungarian and Chinese, and my mum is Aussie, English and Welsh background. I would say that the Chinese was predominant, although my grandmother was Hungarian. She didn't really ever get us into anything Hungarian. She was also interested in the Chinese side of things. I think that the other thing is China's got one of the richest histories of any country in the world. So it's an incredibly unique place and a unique history and a unique culture. And I think that that uniqueness just drew it to me a bit more. But yeah, as a kid, I was much more involved in the Chinese side of things than anything else, you know, going to Chinese dinners all the time, going to Chinese school, which I'm not sure if you did that, but it's something that a lot of us did. And it was interesting. There was a strange response from a lot of the Chinese kids to me being there. They were like, what are you doing here? You're not Chinese. Yeah, you know, we did the red packets all the time. Yeah, the Chinese culture was just something I've always been around. Chinese food. Our family's been probably an excessive sometimes lovers of food. And Chinese food is one of the most incredible cuisines in the and varied cuisines in the world. People don't really realize sometimes that when you say I'm eating Chinese food, you could mean dozens of different cultures. I mean, virtually every city has its own style of food, has its own style of doing things, has its own dialect. So,
well, China's just so vast in the culture in China itself. It's like it's practically the size of a continent, right? So from the food to the language to the dialects, as you move up north from the south, it changes so much. You know, you've got Cantonese cuisine and Cantonese, you know, the language, which is
probably what you and I are a bit more familiar with. We probably grew up eating more of that slightly sweet cuisine, which most Aussies would probably regard as the essence of Chinese cooking. But yeah, it varies unbelievably as you go to different places. And what you and I both understand, but probably a lot of other people don't realize, is that Mandarin is not anybody's first language in China. It's a standardized thing because there are so many different dialects to be able to allow everybody to communicate within the country.
Unless you're from Beijing, of course, or up north.
Yeah. Yeah. But otherwise, it's... Look, to be honest with you, the people who speak in the Beijing dialect, half of the rest of China doesn't understand them either. They've got a very, very unique way of speaking up in Beijing.
Yeah. What are your favourite things about the Chinese culture? Is it the food? Is it
The food would be the first thing that most people say. The food's definitely a part of it. I do love the language as well. I know that for English speakers who haven't grown up speaking it, it's on the highest scale of difficulty. For me, I felt quite natural probably since I've been doing it since I was a kid and went to Chinese school and all of that. I find the language fascinating. The language is very melodic in its own right because of the tonal usage. I think also there's a certain way that people approach things in China. There's a certain, similar to Japan, there's a certain politeness, the good old pangtao cao ji, avoiding direct confrontation.
Yes.
Sometimes it gets annoying, but there's a certain almost cute and endearing part of it. When people say bye to you, they say bye about 50 times before you can actually leave. They're very, very accommodating. One interesting thing that I learned when I went to Nanjing for the first time and I was staying with a Chinese family over there was you can't eat everything on your plate because what's going to happen is they're going to give you more. You can be full as hell. You can tell them, no, I'm done. But if you have cleaned the plate up, which of course you're going to do with good Chinese cooking, they're just going to give you more. So you have to make sure you leave some. Stuff like this was just intriguing to me. I mean, I'm an intellectually curious person. So for me, it was sort of an endless well of interesting things to find out.
So tell us about your time in China. How long were you there for? I mean, obviously you've done multiple trips to China, yeah. But particularly your trip to Nanjing seemed like it really shaped. Would you say it shaped you as a person or it shaped your music career and how so?
Look, most of my first trips to China were to Hong Kong because that's closer to where my family's from Guangzhou. So, you
same
know,
as mine.
All of the southern Chinese sort of areas, and it's always funny because Nanjing means literally south city, but it's not that south. My time in Nanjing was actually for school. It was a school trip. My school, for whatever reason, were very forward thinking and established a campus in Nanjing, and we went there for 5 weeks. Probably explored and got more of the history than you would on any normal trip you go by yourself, because virtually what we did every day was we would bike out as a group to historical sites, engage directly with the culture and with the people. You know, half the time was go up to people that you can find, locals, and ask them about things. Wasn't too hard for me. it was pretty hard for other people. They sort of, when they first went to China, because part of this trip was for people who were studying Chinese, because Chinese was studied at our school. And when they were speaking Mandarin, a lot of Aussies don't realize that if you don't use the tones, they actually don't understand you, which they were shocked by because they said, well, we're saying the words and we're saying them in the right order. Surely that's enough. No, you actually need to be saying the tone specifically. So that was something that was very surprising for people. But look, we were just immersed in it for more than a month, nonstop eating local food, seeing local historical sites, running up stairs to the mausoleums, seeing all of the different parts of the Great Wall, because it wasn't just Nanjing. On that trip, we went to Shanghai and we went to Beijing as well. We got to see a fair bit of everything in that trip, and I think that it definitely played a part in continuing to immerse me in the culture. I wouldn't say that it was central to it, because I'd been to China before, and I'd been to China after. Next time we went to Xi'an, which was a little bit of a different experience, because Xi'an back when I went, when I was in my late teens, was not as developed as it is now. It's a place that's probably known more than anything else for its unbelievable food. But it's got its own wall, just as Nanjing has. So people think, oh, the Great Wall of China. No, there's the Nanjing Wall, there's the Xi'an Wall. I think just being in that spot made me realize how incredibly interesting of a country it is. Not to say that Australia is boring, but when you've been here your whole life, you've seen a lot of what there is to see. A country that's as diverse and as different as that just makes you intrigued to want to go there and experience it yourself. So I think that was a big part of potentially what pushed me in that direction, if nothing else.
Going back to your music for a moment here, I'd love to hear more about how you, because obviously you've got that perfectionism. I do too. And I find it at times it hinders, but at times it's a very effective trait. How do you remain authentic when you are, you know, you're obviously under different influences, you've also got, you know, components that will play a significant role in the kind of music that you produce and your artistic expression, how, you know, the cultural influences as well as your perfectionism, how that all ties in together in your music journey?
Well, I think with respect to authenticity, first of all, people don't understand how easy it is to be authentic because we all just are our own people and we all just have natural influences from different places. It's virtual, unless you're trying to be one person, you're going to end up being a mix of all of them. And I think that's something that was the same for me. I just had a lot of different influences. I couldn't be any one of them. There were things that I preferred. You know, I, for example, I really like the way that Stevie Wonder sings, but I don't have exactly the same voice as Stevie Wonder. My voice as a kid was more suited to Michael Jackson. Then as I grew up, my voice suddenly got super, super deep. And for a while, I couldn't sing very high. And so I started singing songs by people like Jason Mraz, did a bit of Barry White for a while, actually, which was a very funny period. I don't really remember too much about it, to be honest. And I got into people like Luther Vandross. Not that I wasn't into him already, but I started prioritizing this sort of thing. And then when my voice break ended after about 5 or 6 years, it was a really bad break. My falsetto started to come back, my high end started to come back, and then I started getting back into Stevie with my voice and where it wanted to sit. I started getting into a few of the really famous falsetto singers like Prince. I was already into Barry Gibb from the Bee Gees. We were into, from a very early age, a quite obscure artist that not many people are aware of, called David Lasley, who was one of the best falsetto singers of all time, but virtually nobody knows who he is. If you look him up on YouTube, I mean, his most famous songs have about 1,500 views. He was James Taylor's backup singer. Was a backup singer for a famous artist, but he was unbelievable. And all of these sorts of people, after my voice came back, I just got into because it started to fit where my voice was going. So I think that it wasn't hard to be authentic because I was guided by what my voice inherently wanted to do. And then the styles of music that I liked were just naturally pushing me in a certain direction without me having to force it too much. And I'm somebody who from a very early age loved to imitate. But I found that at the end of the day, when you try to imitate somebody, you end up sounding like yourself. Unless you're really, really diligent and you're obsessed with an artist to the point of being an impersonator, you're going to sound like yourself regardless of what you do. I think whether you force it or whether you don't, you're going to be unique and authentic. I think that one thing about authenticity, though, is you shouldn't try too hard to be somebody else if you want to be your own artist. You shouldn't try too hard to force certain things. And my perfectionism, and this is, I think, an important lesson. It was an incredibly important lesson for me that I got a few years ago from a producer. And this ties into my perfectionism hindering me, but also then, I suppose, showing me the way in a sense. I had a producer tell me, "You sound like, when you're singing, just constantly thinking about your voice." He said, "Why are you not thinking about the lyrics, about telling the story, about singing the song?" I said, "I've never thought about that. I've always just thought about not making a mistake, wanting to get that sound perfect." What was incredibly interesting was he told me, "Just for this take, think about the lyrics, completely get rid of your perfectionist outlook on your voice." And my timing and my vibrato, my expression was actually much, much more precise and much more perfect than it was when I was trying too hard to be perfect and trying too hard to be something that I wasn't. Since that point a few years ago, I completely changed the way that I sing, and now I feel like I sound a bit more like myself.
How do you approach each performance? How do you prep yourself? What are the things that you do to, especially because I know you are also naturally, you have a tendency towards being an introvert. When you're performing, you're around people. How do you prep yourself for that?
Well, I think this is probably true of a lot of artists could tell you the same thing. When you're on stage, especially if you're on an actual stage and you've got a spotlight on you, you can't see anybody in the audience. I think it's almost like singing to people who you expect to just have a certain response to you rather than singing in an intimate setting. If I was singing, I'd be more nervous, and a lot of people would say the same thing, singing to my friends or singing to my family or singing to people I know, than singing to strangers. Also, I think it was kind of an anomaly for me as a kid. I had been performing since I was so young that to me, it didn't seem like it was something daunting or something foreign. It was very natural. I think also I loved embodying, you know, I grew up watching Michael Jackson. I grew up watching people like this who, some of the best performers of all time. For me, all I was doing was trying to capture some of that myself, see the enjoyment and the feeling that they were giving me, and trying to imitate and bring that to fruition in my own right on stage. So to me, it felt natural. It didn't feel forced. It didn't feel like I was dealing with the things an introvert probably would in that situation. On the other hand, you know, public speaking was something that was quite daunting for me and for everybody else. You know, the thing that people are apparently scared of more than death is public speaking. And I certainly struggled with that for a while. I seriously struggled with interacting with people in a more general sense. I was very socially awkward, didn't really understand the social cues and how to act. So I was a super introvert. I still am a super introvert, but I feel like, especially in professional settings, I just go into a different zone. And I did a couple of little English oral things for VCE where I was forced to be up there public speaking and up there almost in a performance setting, because you're graded on how well you speak, how articulate you are, how fluent you are with your speech. And so I prepped it like I would prep a performance in advance. And ever since then, I've been really comfortable speaking in front of a camera. I've been really comfortable speaking in front of people and to people. Yes, it was a very interesting way that that developed. But I think that my performances was always something I was not particularly nervous about. As a kid, I was not nervous. I'm much more nervous now than I am as a kid because I think that I've realized my perfectionist nature a little bit more. I have a little bit of a more trained ear to hear where I'm going wrong. And so therefore, I can tell straight away if I've made a mistake. I couldn't do that as a kid as much. For all of these reasons, and also because I just don't want to get anything wrong, and because my voice can sometimes be a little bit sensitive, the way that I prep for a performance is a bit crazy, actually, I will say. I do the Mariah Carey thing. I try not to talk very much on the day before a performance. I'll load up on way too much water starting the day before a performance. On the day of the performance, I will also continue doing it. I'll have a water bottle with me to wake up to. As soon as I wake up, I'll get some water in me to make sure my throat and my mouth is nice and moist and prepped. I will traditionally, depending on when the gig is in the day, I will have almost certain time slots where I'll do things.
Tell us about this.
Yep. I did for a long time gigs at about 6 p.m. And my routine was constantly drink water throughout the day, have that full water bottle. I would scull a 600ml Mount Franklin as soon as I woke up, go downstairs, have another full glass of water with breakfast. Breakfast would not involve milk because dairy stuffs up the sinuses and the vocal cords and things. I would basically stick to nothing but water. No chili. So I had to be a bit cautious with the Chinese food on these sorts of days. I also would make sure that I didn't eat too soon before a performance because you can get what's called silent reflux. You're not actually feeling anything, but naturally because you've eaten something, you're getting little disruptions, annoying things happening in the throat. I would have these special, not lozenges, but little lolly type things. I think I've actually got them from about 20 years ago still in there. They'll be off by now, but they were called Thayers. They were specifically used to coat the throat and the vocal cords before a performance. Now I don't need that anymore. I'm just incredibly careful. At about 3 p.m. on a day when I had a gig, that's when I would have my shower, clean out my sinuses, make sure my nose is all clear. And because I've got a bit of a naturally blocked kind of nose situation. I think that comes from my Chinese grandfather. He had a bit of a stuffed up nose. I've got that as well. Get myself into my whatever outfit I'm performing in. What I now do is I get out a straw, I chuck it in a bottle, or I chuck it in a cup, fill it up with about 1 to 1.5 centimeters of water, put the straw in so it's hovering just above the bottom, and you start going through the straw. And what that does is, it's actually scientific, this is not just me being a nutcase, it creates back pressure on the vocal cords, which massage them when they're swollen, but also just help work them into the day. Most people suggest, you should do this for about 5 to 10 minutes after a performance, maybe 5 to 10 before, and then do a bit of a warm-up. Yeah, not me. I probably do it for about 1.5 hours before a performance. Then I do a very specific warm-up that starts with the bubbles kind of things, and then a few more classic warm-ups that people do, the da-da-da, that sort of thing. Continue not to talk. I'll be very angry if I did. For a while, I was very angry if I did have to say a word. A bit petty of me, but at the time, my voice was not in the best condition, so I really genuinely didn't think I could get through 3 hours if I had been talking beforehand. And look, to be honest with you, 3 hours is a long time to sing, so I wasn't all just doing it because I'm crazy, mostly because I was crazy. Nowadays, I'm a little bit better. My voice is in better condition. I realize that you can't just go around not talking all day when you have to sing. I mean, I work as a lawyer, so I'm on the phone negotiating all day. I'm on the phone talking to people, doing investigating and that sort of thing. I can't not talk. It's impossible. So I've had to learn to deal with that. I say that as if for somehow I was disadvantaged by having to talk before a performance. No, I'm just crazy. After a performance, because my voice will be pretty tired, I'll do the straw for probably a couple of hours. When I get home, while I'm on the computer, I'll just be going constantly, noise the hell out of my family, because by this time we're getting close to bed. If it's a rare occasion where I'll have a long performance the next day, and I've just sung for 3 hours, I'll be doing the straw for maybe 5-6 hours. And then in the morning, I'll make sure I wake up at about 6 a.m. so I can do it for another 2 or 3 hours. And I genuinely need it, because if I've done a really crazy performance on a certain night, I'll wake up the next day and I won't be able to go higher than about... It's an unfortunate thing, but it also means that I've got my routines down. I know what I want to do on my performance days. I make sure I block out that time if I can. I just approach them in a very methodical way and make sure that I'm prepped as best I can. I think that there's nothing that can ever be bad about preparation, about over-preparing, because when you actually get on stage, when you actually put yourself in the performance like a sportsman, if you've actually done the work beforehand, you're not just winging it when you're there, you're just going to be better off. And I believe that preparation is more fundamental than anything. But I have loosened up because there was that thing about me being too in my head about my voice. When I've loosened up, when I've learned to communicate with the audience a bit better rather than just having them there and focusing on myself and making sure I get it right, making sure I impress them, instead of doing that, trying to communicate with them, telling them the story has sort of changed completely the way that I sing, the way that I perform, and the way that I engage with my audience. I think now I'm a bit more about truly communicating my music to them rather than just making sure there aren't any problems with my music.
How do you get out of your own way? How do you get out of your head and out of your own way? I mean, you're a lawyer by trade. You obviously have grown up valuing education. Bit of a perfectionist. It's okay. We all are. How do you get out of your own way and out of your head?
I think that's something I'm 100% still working on. For instance, I'm doing a recording. I did a recording session earlier today, so the old voice is a bit spent. I spent a couple of hours on a song that I'd done the other day. Now, today I'm in quite a good mood because I had a good recording session. The other day after I'd first recorded this song, I was in a terrible mood after I finished. I was thinking, oh, bloody hell, how am I going to get this done if that's the way I'm singing? Can you even sing? I get myself into this mindset still.
It's frustrating, isn't it?
It's crazy what I do to myself sometimes. I think that at the end of the day, there's a couple of things that have helped me work through it. The first is that I've started to accept that perhaps I'm not as bad as I think I am sometimes. I know that's a weird way of thinking about it, but it is something I've tended to go into because I've always, again, I've grew up listening to the best of the best, not just the best of the current era, but the best of all time. And I've always compared myself to them. And when I feel like I come up short against them, I just can't deal with it. And that's not because, you know, I think that I'm comparable to them. I could never hope to approach that level of quality and those sorts of legacies. But it is what I compare myself to. I feel like if I'm not competing with the best in the world, well, I'm failing somehow. Mm. When I'm hearing a professional track by a top artist and then I'm listening to a track of my own and I'm thinking there's something wrong here, I just can't deal with it. And again, how I get out of my own way is, I suppose, I make myself better to the point where I don't have to get in my way. If I can be happy with my performances because I've done enough work that I'm happy with them, I just get out of my own way naturally because I'm in a good mood because I'm doing okay. In terms of getting out of my own way in general, I think I've just, as I said, learned to accept that I'm not as terrible as I think I am sometimes. I've learned that these processes take time. I've learned that I'm my own person and I can accept that and be happy about that and be proud of that, as opposed to always comparing myself to other people. I think that comparison is important because when you're striving for something, you need to have a goal, you need to have a benchmark. But I've learned that perhaps it's not always the best thing to be constantly comparing yourself to other people. I think that's definitely helped me out. I compare myself to myself, and even then I still get annoyed because I'll listen to myself one day, I'll listen to myself another day and go, why does it sound so different? So I'm definitely still working on it. I would say I don't get out of my way enough still. It's a tough problem because you can tell yourself, get out of your way, be proud of yourself, but you still, at the end of the day, are going to be annoyed by the things you're annoyed about. That perfectionist nature is something you can't just toss out the window. It will always be there. You'll still cringe when you're listening to yourself back. You'll still do these things. That's, you know, almost a physical reaction. You can't just toss those away and pretend they don't exist. So I think it's about learning how to deal with them in a mature sense. That's the best I can do.
In our culture as well, we are brought up being compared. I don't know if your parents did that, but
They did. They were incredibly supportive at the same time. But often I think what they would do is, like, they said, you can do better than this. We know you can. You know you can. And look, I did. To be honest with you, they mostly said it when I was being lazy. So it wasn't in a way that was, I think, forceful, unkind, or in a way that pressured me. There was this sense that, hey, you've got something. You should be trying to make the most of it. You shouldn't just be tossing it away. And it's not as if, like, they're saying, oh, you've got a special skill for this. I know you hate doing it. You should take advantage of it. They knew that I loved it and they knew that I had a certain potential. And so they said, no, come on, let's make the most of this. This is something that could be really great, could be really amazing. So they were incredibly supportive in that sense. I think at the end of the day, I ended up putting more of the pressure on myself than anybody else.
We're talking about perfectionism. We're talking about how your family influenced you and how they saw the talent in you from a young age, and they obviously have invested time and support in you. How did you end up in law, and how has law affected your music journey? Does it assist you, or do you think that given how much time everybody has, only 24 hours in a day, how do you balance it all as well?
So I can tell you where my interest in law started. It was from a TV show called Boston Legal. It is something that you could not air on TV nowadays, not a chance. It just seemed fun to me. I think a lot of these TV legal shows present themselves in a way that they are going to make it look more fun than sometimes it can be. But from that point, I got into it. I mean, like a lot of Asian people, I'm very into my schooling since I was very, very young, very into my academics. I loved maths since I was a kid. I loved reading and writing since I was about three. I liked writing essays when I was five about the trips that I went on with my family. It was very strange. The teachers were like, "What are you doing?" And I was just like, "I enjoy it. I think it's fun. I think it's fun doing maths equations at home. I think it's fun doing short stories at home and in the classroom." To me, that was my fun. And so, you know, I went through school. I was a bit of a rowdy teenager, like some people often get, especially when you've had that kind of, I wouldn't say sheltered childhood, I wasn't sheltered, but when you've had a childhood where you're very focused on something and then suddenly you're let loose in your teens. But then when I was thinking about academically what I might want to do after school, the law was just an obvious choice for me. I did legal studies in VCE. My dad always thought that the law was awesome. We really bonded over that side of things as well, and he encouraged me to do it. I was interested in doing it, finished that. It was a bit of a weird process, my schooling after my tertiary education, that is, because I did one semester of law and then I went overseas for 2 years on a deferment to go to Berklee College of Music to study music. And only after that did I come back and finish my law degree. So it took a long time. I've only been a lawyer for a couple of years. I'm still technically, for another 3 weeks or so, in my mandated supervision period that all lawyers have for the first 2 years of their practice. Yeah, it's just something that I was interested in. I find that unlike other subjects that are a little bit more formulaic, maths, sciences, law is quite abstract. It requires you to adopt a very, very unique way of thinking that I could not explain. I don't think anybody could explain to you. That's why we spend an entire 2 introductory courses just learning legal reasoning, because it's its own completely unique thing. And I just found it intriguing. I love to conceptualize. That's something I've always done in my head, is conceptualize ideas, whether it's something to do with, I don't know, a debate topic or some interesting philosophy, music as well. I conceptualize the ideas in my head when I'm listening to my music and thinking, how can we make this better? I'm imagining and hearing the different instruments in my head and wondering what we can add and how it's all going to blend. I do the same thing with law. I conceptualize concepts and strategies and that sort of thing in my head. That's how it feeds into my music. That's where it's the same approach I take in both things. Somewhat methodical, somewhat technical sometimes, but then also very visceral, because I just have the ideas that I'm hearing in my head, which is every musician's dream, is to be able to play what they hear in their head. The same way I approach law, I approach music. Very technical, but also then whatever comes into my head, whatever inspiration is there for a strategy, for a chord, for lyrics, it ends up being the same. As for balancing it, it is hard because I do work 40 hours a week on the law, 9 to 5 every day during the week. I've just accepted that my schedule is rough. So I no longer think of it as a rough schedule. I just think of it as my schedule. You know, I'll be in the studio probably 5-6 hours after work. You know, it sounds much worse when you say it. You know, Wednesday is get out of bed at 7:30 and work until 11 p.m. and get home at 11:30 p.m. That's a 16-hour day. It doesn't feel like that to me. After I finish work, I go to the studio and I'm enjoying what's happening. I like seeing the progress on my music, and I've just accepted that that's the way that I've got to live my life. I've got to live my life doing 70-hour weeks. To me, that's not, because I don't think about it as excess, I don't think about it as being superfluous or unnecessary or troublesome, it makes it easier. If you were to think of it as, oh God, here's now on top of this full-time job, I need to do this, you're going to tire yourself out, because you're going to be thinking, no, now I want to go home. I don't want to go home. After work, I want to go to the studio. After work, I want to work on my music. it's not very difficult to manage. I would say balance is probably the thing that's a little bit more difficult. You know, I would like to be doing more music than I can be doing. I would like to be doing more of certain things than I can be doing. I like to be sharing my music and sharing my social media stuff with my fans more than I can. Sometimes I just get too tired. Sometimes there's not enough hours in the day, as you said. Sometimes I do want to relax. I do want to use the small period that I have each day to wind down. Because otherwise I'll just be super high strung. I'll be like, okay, what's next? What's next? Oh, yeah, I've got to think about that case that I just got assigned the other day. I've got to think about this case that's coming up. I've got to think about this recording session I've got to do. I've got to think about that video I've got to film. So I need my downtime as well. And sometimes that means I can't just be doing everything nonstop. I think that's the only thing that's difficult about it is ideally I'd like to be doing much, much more music if I could.
Do you think that you'd ever go full time in just music and let go of something that you've invested so many years into?
Thankfully, I have an unbelievably good law firm that I work at, and I think that if it did come to the point at which that had to take place, that they'd be willing to accommodate for me. You know, look, at the end of the day, if music was to the point where it could be stable, unfortunately, we're in an industry which is probably the most unstable of any, then I think I would have to consider doing it full-time. Look, I'm hoping that in the near future, I'll get to the point at which music is taking off so much that it is something that I have to do. I would like the choice to be made for me almost, like, to the point where, you know, there's absolutely no way I can continue with this, with this situation, so I have to do it. As opposed to being in a situation where theoretically it's possible if I save up enough leave, which I do, to continue doing both. Unfortunately, my job, for reasons I won't get into, has certain deadlines that can't be missed that mean that even when I take leave, I can't necessarily just stop thinking about these things or leave it to somebody else. I still do have to, if I'm going on, say, a 3-week trip somewhere, I would still have to take my work computer with me, because if I miss those deadlines, basically we would lose a case and I would get fired.
Well, we don't want that.
No.
Okay, so you talked about Berklee. I'd love to hear more about that. How did that influence you? How did that shape you as an artist? And what's your favourite memory?
One of the most essential experiences I've had. Being an Aussie, you know, we like to think sometimes we know what R&B is down here. We really don't. And if you're ever going to learn R&B properly, it needs to happen in the home of R&B. It needs to happen around especially the black community that's grown up in the churches. It's their music. It's their culture. And how can you learn another culture without being immersed in it where it's from? Like without China, how could you possibly learn about the most intricate parts of Chinese culture without going to China? It's the same with R&B. Without going to America, without being in the home of it, without being surrounded by the most authentic R&B musicians who have the same inspirations as you, I couldn't have hoped to develop as an R&B musician. And as soon as I got there, I remember vividly the very first experience I had was, I can't remember what it was called, it was an introductory concert they put on. And one of the singers was this unbelievable R&B singer in his second or third year. And I just looked at him and I said, how is it even possible that I will ever approach that level? That's just the most ridiculous quality singing I've ever seen. And you have to remember, at this point, I'd applied to Berklee and was attending Berklee as a guitarist. I had every intention of engaging in vocal classes and that sort of thing when I was there, but I'd applied as a guitarist. So I'm seeing this singer and I'm just like, that's unbelievable. That's just craziness. Obviously, the classes I learned there were just essential in their own right. Training your ears is incredibly important as a musician. Learning to arrange songs, I learned to arrange for up to 13 instruments. Arrange horn sections, which for me, given the style of music that I do, which is, you know, funk, Earth, Wind & Fire, they've got the biggest and best horn sections of all time. Crazy use of chords, Stevie Wonder, Earth, Wind & Fire, again, the same sort of thing. All of this was necessary for my development and to be able to produce the sort of music that I aspired to, but it was really just being there in that environment that pushed me, being around people that, frankly, were much better than I was, people who I thought I had to catch up to, because I think part of it's because of my perfectionist nature, but I'm unbelievably competitive, and I just couldn't handle sort of being ridiculously inferior to the point where I was sort of like, Jesus, I wouldn't even want to get up on a stage with these people. I feel like I would embarrass myself. Second semester, I decided, you know what? Why am I in this jazz contemporary jazz class when I'm not a jazz musician, trying to sight read jazz standards in different time signatures over different keys? It's going to take me 20 years to even become a decent jazz guitarist when I'm more of a light rock guitarist, fusion guitarist. My vocals have always been the thing that's, I think, set me apart a little bit. My vocals have always been the thing that people have told me, you might be able to do something special here. Let's not waste our time on something that's never going to happen. Not to say that I've abandoned the guitar. I still consider myself as much a guitarist as I am a vocalist, but I decided I'm going to get as good as these people. That was what went through my head. And what I did is from that point on, I took my computer and went to the practice rooms every day for 2 hours, sung every day for 2 hours, was recording myself as I still do now, but at this point, I was having trouble keeping pitch. I remember recording myself to this one Earth, Wind & Fire song called Can't Let Go. I reckon I did that song for 3 weeks on end, just the first verse, because I could never get it right the whole way through. The first verse was only about 20 seconds long, but I could never get it the whole way through without missing pitch at least once, without having an imperfection at least once. I did it to the point where at one point I thought I'd stuffed my voice up, because there was one day where I was singing Marvin Gaye, I was singing Let's Get It On, and trying to get that sort of raspy tone that Marvin Gaye has, which people don't really have naturally unless you're Marvin Gaye, I just felt my voice sort of go. And then I decided, hang on, I've got to slow this down. But after the voice came back, I was straight into it again, until the point where in my fourth semester I was, a year had passed since this point, and I was now comfortable that I could hold my own against people I felt. And so this is leading to my favourite memory, which was the Singers Showcase. Essentially what this was every semester, or at this point I believe it was each once a year, there's auditions for the Singers Showcase, which is the top 8 people who audition at Berklee will be accepted into this showcase, and you'll perform in front of the whole auditorium and industry people and that sort of thing. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to give this a go. To my surprise, I got in amongst 7 other unbelievable singers. And this is also where another thing started, which was the song that I was assigned to sing for this showcase was Purple Rain.
Wow.
By Prince, which is now a song that I have developed my own spin on, and that people sort of expect me to do at performances, even though it's not my song. I think perhaps the fact that I played guitar influenced that decision on their part a bit. But what you've got to remember is this performance took place on the 21st of April, which was a week after Prince died, 21st of April 2016. Pretty crazy, wild performance. We had a whole band full of the best student musicians behind us, about 30-piece band. I just wanted to go out there. I spent so much time getting every note right. I rehearsed the guitar solo infinitely. I rehearsed my vocals infinitely. I rehearsed where I was going to walk, what gestures I was going to make, where I was going to look. As always happens, and I've had this happen to me so many times, I got sick the day before the performance, and I was really, really upset, as you can imagine. I did everything I possibly could to get my voice right. I drank tea. I did all of this sort of thing. Get to the day before the performance, I'm still feeling sick. I'm still feeling pretty bad. I'm doing my trying not to talk. I'm doing my bubbles. I'm doing all of this. I get to the performance. I'm a bit nervous. I don't know what's going to come out of my voice when I get on stage. And when I got on stage and I performed, I think I did one of the best performances I've ever done in my life. After that, I sort of had a bit more self-belief. Standing on that stage, you know, the crowd cheering, certain parts of the song where I could tell they were really getting into it. It felt more like the audience was alive than in previous performances. It was, you get your claps at the end, you get your applause. This time around, every part of the song that I did something that I had wanted to impress people with, they were getting really impressed by. And I was unbelievably satisfied when I finished that. And with a stage that big in front of about 3,000 people, I felt like I was where I belonged. For me, it was my favorite memory at Berklee, because I think it's when I felt like all of my hard work had come to something, all of my persistence had come to something, and I could see a direction for where I wanted to go in the future.
Wow, that is incredible. What would you say it came down to? What was the factor that made it such a good performance?
I think for the first time I realized how unique certain aspects of my voice are. As a kid, I had only ever sung in my sort of chest voice, which is what I'm talking in now. That was incredibly high because I was just a little squeaky. Then when I got to my voice break, my voice just dipped down to where it is now. I was singing at around the same range where I talk. I'd lost the ability to do anything high for such a long time that I didn't really think about it. My high voice came back. I also developed a falsetto, which I hadn't ever made use of much in the past. But given that I loved singing the Bee Gees and singing Earth, Wind & Fire, which have falsetto everywhere, when I was just singing, I discovered that I had a kind of thing going and could make something of it. But I didn't realize that it was anything crazy special. I just liked singing in it. When I did this performance of Purple Rain, which is the first performance of a Prince song I'd ever done in public, and the first time I'd really dedicated myself to singing a Prince song properly, tried to take advantage of the strength I had in my falsetto as much as I could, which is a very strange thing, because falsetto is traditionally, because what it is is your vocal cords stand up on end like that. It's supposed to make them generate incredibly fast frequencies, but for it to be very thin, because your vocal cords are very thin. When this happens, when they get raised up, they get taut. It's supposed to be very thin and very airy. But mine was the opposite. Mine had this sort of Barry Gibb, super, super strong and bright and powerful sense to them. And combining that with some of resonance that I'd learned from all of the amazing black singers I was around at Berklee, started to use it in ways I thought, hang on, this is something cool and unique that only I feel like I haven't heard too many people do. And when I got up on stage and started doing those sections, those were the sections that everybody was sort of going wild at, and I thought, well, maybe this is something that I should not use as a crutch. I don't ever want to use it as a crutch. This is maybe something that I can take advantage of and continue to utilize in order to establish a unique place for myself in my music. And yeah, so I think since then, that's where I found something that I could do that I hadn't heard anybody else do before.
It sounds like your journey has evolved so much, and a lot of it was not so much the, you know, to do with just your voice and your talent, but it's also your journey within yourself and accepting yourself and loving yourself and realizing your talent, and then letting go of a lot of the things that hindered you that may have been, you know, to do with your own kind of, you know, I guess where you set the bar, which is so high. And that's so good as well. You know, it seems like your formal education, your career, all of that, you know, you've been working on so many aspects of yourself. My last question for you today, Geordie, is were there ever any points where you nearly or you considered giving up? And for those that are listening, where it might not be music, it could be something else, where they've gone, no, maybe they've compared themselves to someone else and they've gone, no, I think I'm going to let this one go. What would you say to that person? Did you ever have moments where you considered giving up? And it doesn't have to be music either.
I think the only sense of giving up that I may have had would have been related to music. Somehow I always thought that in the background there were opportunities waiting for me. There were people I was engaged with that I thought, this is going to go somewhere somehow. But I always had this doubt in my mind, and I thought, you should never be confident in something when you haven't been shown the method by which it's going to be achieved. If you're just told it's going to be achieved, I don't really trust that anymore, especially in an industry like this one. I think there are so many people who have been stuffed around by this industry, who have failed in this industry. I was a bit blind to it at that point, I think. And when all of that sort of came crashing down, I thought, Where's my path? Where's my path to doing anything meaningful? Because I'm a supreme sort of introvert, I knew I couldn't do it myself. I knew I had zero chance of getting myself out there, no matter what I did vocally, no matter what I did in a recording session. I knew that there was zero chance. For instance, I can tell you how this manifests. I put an unbelievable amount of time into writing all the instruments on three tracks that I'd written. I spent months doing the sheet music, doing the horn sections, doing every part. We paid a good amount of money to get it recorded in a studio. Now I'm not happy with the recordings, but at the time I was very happy with them. One of those songs won the Australian Songwriting Contest, came first. That song, after I released it, about a month after I released these songs, they had about four plays each, I think, on Spotify. Even still, I would be extraordinarily surprised if about 5 years on since their release, they have more than 100. When I saw that, I thought, how am I supposed to succeed in this industry? That's how hard I worked for that. That's how much stuff I did. I'm doing it all by myself, and this is the result. I thought, what's the point? I'm wasting my time. You know, even now, I still have some doubts. I think I'm just a person who doubts. I think that a lot of perfectionists are. Perfectionism goes hand in hand with doubt, because it's always, is there something that's not perfect? Is there something that could fall apart? And I think that, you know, I should actually revise. I don't think there's a time that I ever gave up, but there were times when I thought that I don't have a chance, that I thought there's no way that anything happens. I'm going to be a musician who just sort of does law. That becomes the priority. The music fades away eventually. I'll still play now and then. It's just going to be something that never happens. And thankfully, I didn't sort of give in too much to those thoughts and just persisted. You know, now great things are happening, and it's important for everybody to understand that. I mean, I don't want to sort of spout platitudes and cliches like just believe in yourself. I think it's a bit more complicated than that. I think that just saying I believe in myself will not get you anywhere. You have to, I think, be a bit more practical and understand that if opportunities aren't coming your way, there's usually a good reason for that. For me, it was my introversion and my failure to actually take advantage of opportunities when they came my way, my failure to collaborate with other people, my failure to engage other people to work with me. Wanting to do it all by myself was my problem. Now, that might not be the same for everybody who who runs into hurdles and bumps in their careers, but I think the important thing is, if you're having trouble, if you're struggling, find the reason why. Realize that there's something you can do about it. It's not hopeless because you're bad or because there's anything wrong with the way that you sing or the way you play guitar or your music. There's usually a good reason. I think some of it's because we're a bit of a loose country and people go to gigs to drink half the time and not to follow people. So I think we're a bit of an unfortunate society in that sense. I think do the practical thing. Identify what it is that you're lacking in and try and improve it. Try and be better every day with what you're doing, not only as an artist, but in a business sense. These days, you need to be a businessman as well as an artist. You can't exclude the two from each other anymore. My practical advice is, don't just shower yourself with I believe in myself and you should believe in me too. Actually find practical, real solutions to the problems you're facing with getting yourself out there or improving your music.
And I think there's always pivotal moments in our journey where, even if you have the doubts of a perfectionist or not, there are always pivotal moments where we can go back to those, I guess, defining times where you go, if I could get through that and if I did that back then, I can do better and I can continue. I believe that every single talented, skilled or not, every single person that puts hard work and effort and energy into something that they believe in, they can make it work and make it happen. So thank you for such an inspiring episode and for sharing such truth and wisdom as well. You know, you're such a young man, but full of so much wisdom and talent. Do you have any last words for the listeners today?
No, I think just thank you for having me on. I'd love to be on again. I'd love if anybody who's interested in my music and my journey wants to follow me on Insta, on TikTok, whatever it may be, it all contributes, it all helps. And yeah, just thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure. I think that I don't often delve very much into my life being the introvert that I am. And it's good to maybe get some things off my chest and discuss things in an open forum where I can understand perhaps a little bit more about myself and about my flaws and the things that I need to improve on as well. Always looking for improvement as a perfectionist.
Yeah, of course. Okay, well, listeners, if you want to follow Jordan, make sure to look him up. It's Jordan.Wong, I believe, on TikTok, and Jordan Wong, one word, on Insta. Make sure that you hit that follow button, because his journey is definitely, he's on an incredible tangent. You continue on this trajectory, there's going to be some amazing things that will come through, and I'm really looking forward to seeing that and being a part of that as well. So thank you again for jumping on, and listeners, thank you so much for tuning in to the Inspired to Thrive podcast. Until next time, stay happy, stay inspired, and continue to thrive and shine. Peace.